Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's also clinical assistant professor at the University of Illinois. And for a long time now, he's been stopping by once a month on a Thursday, and we talk about children's health. And that's what we're doing here this morning. The program will be a little shorter than usual because at 10:40, we will be joining National Public Radio for their coverage of the inauguration. But we wanted to, rather than not do the program at all, we thought, well, shorter, we can do that too. And I just want to make sure that people who are listening know that if you have a question and you would like to talk with the doctor, don't wait, because we won't have quite as much time as usual. Right now, if you have a question, in fact, you can give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Well, good morning. It's good to be back.
Something we thought that we might talk about here, which is in the news now, concerns meningitis. And over time, people have called in and they have asked questions about that. Particularly, I think we have had probably questions from some people who had children who were in college. And you hear from time to time that there are outbreaks of meningitis. And the question has been, well, should I make sure my son, my daughter, before they head out there, gets vaccinated? And I think in the past you had said, my advice would sort of be wait. And if there's an outbreak, be the first person in line. I think that's sort of what you said. Now, the FDA just within the past, I think, couple of days has approved a vaccine. And it's my understanding that, at least from the article that I read, that I think that the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, actually is recommending that everybody who live in dorms where people are closely packed together and that sort of the issue, that they get it. So what do you think?
I think this is one I can come out and firmly state that, yes, this is a good one. This is a protein conjugate vaccine. The old one was a polysaccharide vaccine, and we don't do well. Our body doesn't make good antibodies against polysaccharide vaccines. We do well against the protein conjugate vaccines. This new one that was just licensed includes ACY and W something or other. So the big four of the meningococcals that cause meningitis are all included in this vaccine. This is a good vaccine. It shows an amnestic response. That is, if you get exposed to the bug or you get another vaccination, your titer goes up instead of down like the old vaccine. And this is a good one.
Okay.
This is one that should be, in my understanding, it's being licensed for 11-year-olds to 55-year-olds.
Okay.
Why not younger? Why not older? I don't know yet. We'll find out about that. But it'll be the two major times we see meningococcal outbreaks are in the very young children, prior to school age, and the teenagers. And again, like you mentioned, mainly the kids that live in college that are packed in college dorms. So this is a good vaccine, and when it comes out and is available, and should be in the next month or so, this is one to get.
All right. And the thinking is that this, well, as far as we know, this should be something that would provide lifelong immunity, so you probably only would have to have it once?
Once. Yeah, I guess probably the answer is not in on that, but it looks like, yeah. It's like our other vaccines, like the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine we've talked about in the past, and the new pneumococcal vaccine for kids. That's protein conjugated, and they're good vaccines.
Okay.
So this one should give good protection.
All right. Our guest this morning is Dr. Robert Bocek. He is a pediatrician and is with us once a month on a Thursday to talk about children's health. And if you have a question, the kind of thing that you would discuss with a pediatrician, give us a call. You can talk with the doctor. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller right here in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, could you talk a little bit about ADD in children and how it's diagnosed? We suspect it in my son and have the school is doing, I don't think they even call it testing, and they said that the final determination will be up to the doctor.
Yes.
So how did? Could you tell me just briefly how that works?
This has always been a tough one for me. Basically, it's a diagnosis of symptoms listed, and it goes to the DSM, the diagnostic or whatever it is, mm-hmm. code. And if you have so many symptoms from column A and so many symptoms from column B, the diagnosis is attention deficit disorder. I guess the trouble I have is how do you weigh and measure these symptoms?
Right.
And this always made me uncomfortable as a pediatrician. You know, I like blood tests because, you know, the white count is such and such or the titer is such and such. But how do you weigh and measure these symptoms of fidgetiness or inattentiveness and that sort of thing? And it's much tougher. How old is he?
7.5.
Okay.
And I wondered, especially, how does the pediatrician do it when he might only see the kid once or twice, three times a year, and then the parents see him every day?
You know, I think that always made me uncomfortable because, you know, the teacher sends actors' rating scales or something and says, this is the way I measured this child's behavior. And I think often it amounted to, you know, it could be, let's try a medication and let's see how it works. And if it significantly helps, then we'll talk about continuing it. If it doesn't do anything, we can fiddle around with the dose a little bit. If we adjust the dose a little bit and still nothing happens, nothing remarkable happens, we say the diagnosis is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or he doesn't qualify for Medicaid or the medication isn't helping. I think the other important thing is there's about 6 different mental health diagnoses that have similar symptoms. So I think it's important to thoroughly evaluate this child. What's going on in the family? Has there been a recent death, recent divorce? Is this child depressed? Could something else be going on? I think the other thing to look at closely is, does Johnny have learning disabilities? Is that why he's not doing well in school? It has nothing to do with his behavior, because a child won't be bored in school. You know, if they don't understand what's going on, say their hearing's deficient, or they're having trouble reading, or their vision's deficient, they can act out in ways very similar to the child with attention deficit disorder, and it's just because they're bored, or they're not with the picture because they don't hear well, they don't see well, or something else is going on, or there's a processing problem going on.
Okay, and that's what they are doing. They're doing the whole battery of tests.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is attention deficit disorder is a pervasive disorder. It's not only a school problem. It's a church problem. It's a Boy Scout meeting problem. It's a problem in the household. Is your child having problems? Do you notice anything? And do other people notice anything? Does he have friends? Is he welcome at other people's houses? Is he manifesting the same behaviors that the school is noticing in other situations?
Okay.
And I think that's important to note, too. Although, again, these kids are going to manifest the behaviors mostly in school where the demands are the highest on them. And it depends. I guess the other thing is there's all kinds of severity of attention deficit disorder, too.
Right.
But I found it a very tough, when I was in clinical practice, I found it a very tough diagnosis to make. It made me very uncomfortable. And often it boiled down to, well, it could be, let's try medication. And often what I did, and it made the teachers rather unhappy with me, is I'd do it blind. I'd keep the teachers blind that we were trying the medication.
Mm-hmm.
And with the medications out now, once-a-day dosages of many of the medications are sufficient. It used to be that you had to give a dose in the morning, a dose at noon. Now they make many of the medications are sustained release, so you can give a dose in the morning and don't tell anybody about it and see if the Yeah. See if there's a noticeable difference in his performance in school.
All right.
But it's tough. It's uncomfortable. I understand the quandary you're in.
Okay. Thank you.
Right, well, you're welcome.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to someone else here. We have a caller in Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Just wanted to share a case story from somebody that I know whose son was thought by some doctors to have chronic fatigue syndrome, and it's been going on for 10 years. He's now 21 and has missed lots of high school and college. Very bright kid, but his mother has told me that he had severe memory loss and that his grandfather, who had dementia, could essentially run rings around his grandson cognitively at times. They've just finally found out that he actually has Lyme disease.
Okay.
He was on the West Coast, and so they're not as familiar with Lyme disease there. She discovered through her own work on the Internet that there were two tests for Lyme disease, one of which is not very sensitive, or turns out false negatives more frequently. And he had the more sensitive test just this fall and has now just started treatment with antibiotics. And apparently there is a secondary infection that can come from the tick bite called Babesia, which has psychological or psychiatric ramifications. The kid wandered off and into Seattle and was, he took the car and parked it on the wrong way on a one-way street, left his keys and wallet on the seat in an unlocked car and wandered off shirt without a coat and or shoes and socks.
Wow, it's a good thing it was Seattle, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking severe problems for this poor family that's been going on for 10 years. Not that severe. That sort of stuff was this fall. But I just wanted to toss out to people, you know, you hear chronic fatigue syndrome, and I don't know how frequently it's associated with Lyme disease, but you know, I'm just suggesting that when people have odd things going on, it might be worth looking to see whether it's one of the things that Lyme disease can cause. It's really, really sad.
Yeah. We had a saying, if you hear hoofbeats, it's probably not a zebra, it's probably a horse. So, yeah, you look for the most common things first, but when you don't find an answer, you know, when common things don't fit the picture, then you start looking for the zebra, you start looking for the more exotic things. And Lyme disease, in most people, is a acute self-limited infection. With treatment or not, that most people, the vast majority of people, get better. Some people will go on to develop cardiac conditions. Some people go on to develop arthritis, and in the case you're talking about, this child, adult, developed sort of dementia type things, and it's just a funny disease, and it is hard. You don't. Well, it's basically in Lyme, Connecticut, in the Northeast, and we don't think about it very often here. And I'm sure in California and the West Coast, they think about it even less.
Interestingly, in a separate book we were looking at, it's called That Takes Ovaries, about women who've done daring things. There was a woman in England who was curious about the kids missing school for extended periods of time and did research on it and found that Lyme disease was, and chronic fatigue syndrome, maybe Lyme disease, I'd have to go back and double check, was a major cause for this, and stood up to the medical establishment with her proof. Trying to track this stuff down is really, really difficult, and sometimes the family has to really augment the medical establishment because doctors are overloaded and you don't have a lot of time to see people and deal with this. Really,
and chronic fatigue syndrome is another peculiar thing that, you know, there's no blood test. There's no lab test that says, hey, this is the diagnosis.
Right.
I just
thought I would toss that out in case it happened to help somebody.
Okay, thank you.
Good, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Robert Bocek. He is a pediatrician. He is with us monthly on a Thursday to talk about children's health, and that's what we're doing here this morning. And I also do want to remind folks who are listening that this morning at 10:40, We will be going to National Public Radio for coverage of the inauguration. So that means we will be here for about another 20 minutes, and we have some other calls, and we can certainly take those folks. And we'll try to get in as many as we can in the time we have. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone next in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you were familiar with a book called The Impossible Child, and it looks at allergy in relation to activity and behavior problems.
No, I'm not familiar with that book, but certainly, yeah, certain. Yeah, you know, I think.
Okay, so I guess my question was, if you haven't heard of the book, have you heard of the concept? Of going on, say, you know, looking at maybe a slight allergy that's not necessarily what you'd call, you know, normal allergy from ragweed or something like that, but it affects a person's behavior, and then trying to eliminate that from the diet.
Okay, yeah, and that's, yeah, I'm not sure I believe in that. But certainly, all right, let's take a common allergy. Let's take the kid with allergic rhinitis. You know, they are allergic to ragweed. Or we can even talk about food allergies. You know, they eat something, it causes stomach cramps or something, it causes mild discomfort, it doesn't cause diarrhea or anything overt, but these kids are uncomfortable. So their behavior is going to be funny because they're uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
Or the child with allergic rhinitis who, you know, his nose itches all the time. Or, you know, he's having trouble breathing, he's stuffy all the time. Or the child with eczema who just has itchy skin. Their behavior may be funny, too, because they're chronically uncomfortable with itchy skin. And I think these are the things when we look at children's behavior, we need to look at everything that's going on. You know, maybe it's attention deficit disorder. Maybe it's depression. Maybe we need to fix this child's nasal allergies. Or maybe we need to look, maybe this kid, you know, maybe on further history you find out that this child's got stomach pain chronically, and maybe we do need to look at the diet for possible food allergies. Or, you know, maybe we need to fix something else that's going to relieve a symptom that's going to help this child just emotionally and intellectually function better.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. And again, to line 1, this is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have my question is twofold. Some friends of ours, they have a 9-month-old son who weighs over 30 pounds. And he has been overweight since, I don't know, 3 months of age. And they're not from this country, and so I don't know exactly what they're calling from when they determine what to feed their son.
Okay.
They were giving him half and half.
Ooh.
Because it didn't have vitamin D. They thought vitamin D was bad.
Okay.
And all kinds of other things. You know, they give him whole milk and stuff. And I have tried to, you know, gently suggest certain things. I gave her some formula, and she just gave it to her neighbor. She won't give her son formula.
Okay.
Now, they haven't taken him for regular checkups either, so he's only had one series of shots.
Okay.
So I'm wondering if they've done permanent damage to this child by overfeeding him. Certain motor skills seem to be normal, but others are behind. Like, he can't lay on his stomach, he doesn't crawl, he doesn't roll. He can stand and, you know, they hold his hands and he can walk a little bit and stuff like that. But I'm just wondering if he is in danger of getting diabetes and, you know, and also the second part of my question is what can I do to try and, beyond encouraging them to take their son to the doctor, you know what I mean? What can I do to try and help this kid?
Okay, you know, there's a cultural problem here, isn't there?
Yeah.
Are they doing permanent damage to the child? Hopefully not. You know, hopefully as this child gets older, He will start taking control of his own diet, and he won't be fed anymore. He'll want to feed himself, and hopefully he will lose weight because, gee, at 9 months and 30 pounds.
Over 30 pounds.
Over 30 pounds. He's probably about twice the size that the average nine-month-old is.
She gave me some clothes that are too small for him, and one is a jacket for a two-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's really distressing.
And certainly half and half, yeah, the fat quantity of half and half is certainly astronomical compared to, yeah, what's recommended.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, how can you help this family? I think just what you're doing, just be their friend and make, try and help them the best you can, give them advice the best you can. You know, I'm involved with the Multicultural Health Center at the University of Illinois at Orchard Downs, and we've discussed this often, that people from other countries, other cultures, can't find the foods they are used to here, and they're really sort of in a quandary. They don't know what to do, and it sounds like that's what this family's going through. We don't like vitamin D milk for whatever reason. Vitamin D is a plot to do something bad, and we in America, well, we're sort of egocentric, I suppose, but we know vitamin D is good. I'm not sure vitamin D is, I'll accept vitamin D is good, but yeah, these folks are just doing abhorrent nutritional things as far as the Americans are concerned, and I'm sure as far as their country's concerned too, but they're left in a void.
Mm-hmm.
They can't find their foods, the foods they like, so they're doing other things to get around it. And I think what you can do is help. You've had children of your own?
I have a 6-month-old, and I think that by example they're starting to make some adjustments.
Oh, good.
What they're doing, because I mean, my son, he stands up, he
yeah.
crawls around and stuff, and so they're seeing that he's doing things that their son has never done.
Yes.
So, and, you know, I've tried to show the mother how I prepare food, because I make all of his food and everything.
Oh, good.
But see, she is the main provider for the household, so her husband is caring for their son, and he's older.
Okay.
So I think he's of a different generation.
Okay.
So I'm not, you know...
And you can't help, yeah, you can't set the example for, she's willing to be educated, he's not.
Right, right. I think there's a little bit of a pride issue there. But I was wondering if, you know, if it's possible, I mean, are there services in town where I can set up a free checkup for them or something so they could at least have someone look at their son to see, you know, if he's okay.
Do they have health insurance? Do you know?
I don't think he's covered.
Okay. Then probably actually, there's a couple places they could go. Francis Nelson Health Service.
Okay.
We'll see him. I think the other thing is you might call Champaign-Urbana Public Health District.
Mm-hmm.
And get them involved with the WIC program, the Women's and Infants and Children's Nutritional Program.
Okay.
And I think they could give them some dietary advice. They can get them free formula, too, but they won't use it. But I think they can talk to them about, yeah, they can talk to them about normal growth, and they can talk to them about a normal diet and getting this boy on a more appropriate diet for an infant of his age.
Yeah. Now, have you seen children that are overweight like this? I mean, what kinds of health problems do they encounter?
Well, at this stage in life, he's probably okay.
Okay.
You know, because the diabetes, the type 2 diabetes, doesn't appear till adolescence usually.
Okay, so it is possible for him to grow into his weight.
Oh, yes, okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think his prognosis is not dismal at all.
Okay.
Yeah, I think things can be reversed nicely.
Now, and giving him milk... you know, at such an early age for so long. I mean, is he prone to anemia or anything?
He may be iron deficient.
Okay.
Yeah, he may have anemia. He certainly had too many calories.
Yeah.
And I don't know what kind of solid foods he's getting.
Okay.
But I presume he's not had the best source for iron in infancy is the prepared cereals.
Yeah. No, he hasn't had that.
And iron fortified formula, and he's not been on iron. He's not been on formula, so he may be anemic.
Okay. Now she does nurse him and everything.
Okay.
But you know, at this point, it's not very very frequent.
I'm sure that breast milk is probably a minor part of his diet at this age.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Good
I'll
luck.
Look into those services.
Yeah. I think that's the best place to start, and hopefully they'll accept them.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
And hopefully they'll contact somebody who's culturally sensitive.
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, intrude in their home life and have someone show up at their door and accuse them of child abuse or anything.
Yeah.
You know.
No, that won't happen.
Okay.
But I think the WIC program, the people at Public Health and the WIC program, may be able to help them. Are they graduate students or?
Yes.
Okay. The other thing they might do is contact the Multicultural Health Service.
Okay.
Health Center at Orchard Downs.
Okay.
And get scheduled with a nurse practitioner, a pediatric nurse practitioner there to talk about nutrition.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye.
We'll continue. The next caller is in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an older person. I'm over 40 and considering adoption or even pregnancy. I think I have a grip on the obstetrical implications. I was wondering if you have words of wisdom, words of caution or encouragement for older parents, first time?
Enjoy. Yeah, parenthood, this would be your first parenthood.
Yes, sir.
Enjoy. It's fun. I guess I have a great deal of and I don't think you're unique, because I think we've seen that in this country, that parenthood is being deferred to a later and later age.
I can partially blame medicine, I think you can understand.
Okay.
Medical training.
Okay. Delays. It sounds, are you in the dual degree, the MD-PhD program here?
No, I've been an MD for a number of years.
Oh, okay. Okay. I don't have, you know, I think it, where was it? The country where a woman of age 65 gave birth recently to a child.
Mercy.
You know, that's what I say. I think that's peculiar, but I think being 40-something is still a good parenting age, and enjoy. And I don't have any words of wisdom. You know, I guess the only thing is 40-plus, you can't run with your children as well as a 20-plus, but you can still enjoy. And be rewarded. I think it's great.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Let's see. I think we have another caller here on our toll-free line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I have a question. I have a 6-year-old daughter who has been suffering headache since last October. And then we see doctor, and she did the CT scan and diagnosed as sinus infection.
Okay.
So she has been antibiotic, four kinds of antibiotic, and then finally it doesn't work, neither work. So we see a specialist, and the doctor said, let's try the final antibiotic. It doesn't work. She's going to do the surgery. So that's I'm a little bit concerned about this. She only 6 years old, so is that surgery going to fix the problem for her?
Okay, what sinus is involved, do you know?
Yeah, they just say sinus infection. This little child just can play a headache every day, and now we're still on antibiotic, but seems like it doesn't work. So pretty sure we had to do a surgery.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I have to know what sinus is involved and what kind of surgical procedure are they planning.
Oh, I really don't know.
Because like the maxillary sinus is easy to approach. You can you sedate the child, you anesthetize the child, and you can irrigate that through the nose. You just put a needle through the bone and.
Right, your doctor say she's going to do that, but I'm just wondering, is that going to fix the problem or what?
Hopefully.
I mean, forever.
Yeah, hopefully it will. Hopefully they'll just irrigate that sinus out with saline and just wash all the gunk out of there.
Uh-huh.
And get the plugs out, get the sinus, get that stuff out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of tilt the tables in your child's favor, so the antibiotics will clear the infection that's no longer locked in there.
Uh-huh.
Pus locked in, yeah, boils or pus locked into a closed pocket. The traditional teaching is you got to open that pocket and you got to get that stuff out of there, because it just antibiotics you won't get into an infected pocket like that. They won't penetrate into the middle of it.
And, okay, so another question is that CT scan can help to diagnose? Sometimes I'm just wondering, is that, you know, is this really right diagnose? Because she doesn't have any symptom except in the morning, you know, feels something there. She's just stuck in her nose. She doesn't have fever, you know.
Okay. Yeah, she has chronic sinusitis, so she may, you know, the symptoms are going to be milder. You know, she's not going to have the fever. She's not going to have the green stuff pouring out of her nose. She's going to feel crummy, not terrible, but crummy, and the chronic headaches. And CT scan is the gold standard. She's got sinusitis. There's no doubt about it. Is this sinusitis causing the headache? I don't know, and I don't think any doctor knows. So the answer is, all right, we know she's got sinusitis. We know she's got headaches. Let's clear the sinusitis. Hopefully the headaches will go away, and if they don't, then we'll go on from there.
Okay, so you say we are in the right direction.
I think so.
We have so many doctors, you know,
yes.
It's very, she has been in four kind of antibiotics. Mm. Nothing works, so. Okay. Anyway, thank you.
Right. You're welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I think that we are just about the point that we're going to have to stop. As I said, we're expecting just in a minute or two to be going to National Public Radio, and we're going to have their live coverage of the inauguration. So that means we'd have to cut our conversation with Dr. Bocek here a little short. Well, okay, now we're not quite sure when we're going to be joining. We are going to be going to National Public Radio. We are going to have coverage of the inauguration, so hang in here. We're a little uncertain about what the start time is going to be. And in any case, I think we're probably at the point where we're going to have to say goodbye to Dr. Bocek with our thanks. I want to also thank everybody who called and mention that he will be back again next month, and we'll do it at our regular time.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's it for Focus 584 this morning. Right now, we're going to go to National Public Radio for their coverage of the inauguration.
Since 1789, Americans have gathered in peaceful, dignified ceremonies to transfer and reaffirm the authority of our chief executives. So it is that we gather here again today, looking out over the expanse of greatness that is America, to celebrate our nation, to commemorate its rich history of achievement, to advance the intrepid hopes that reside in the hearts of our citizens, and to give thanks to God for his blessings upon us all. In that spirit, I call now the Reverend Dr. Louis Leon, who will deliver the invocation. Dr. Leon.
Louis Leon is the rector of the St. John's Episcopal Church, the Church of the Presidents, as it's called. The president and his family were there earlier today. Every president since Jefferson has worshipped
him. Let us pray. Most gracious and eternal God, we gather today as a grateful people who enjoy the many blessings you have bestowed on this nation. We are grateful for your vision, which inspired the founders of our nation to create this democratic experiment as one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. We are grateful to you that you have brought to these shores a multitude of peoples of many ethnic, religious, and language backgrounds, and yet have fashioned one nation out of so many cultures and traditions. Even as we celebrate this great moment, we remember before you the members of our armed forces. We commend them to your care. Give them courage to carry out their duties, and courage to face the perils which beset them, and grant them always a sense of your presence in all that they do. Finally, today, we are especially grateful for this inauguration, which marks a new beginning in our journey as a people and a nation. We pray that you will shower the elected leaders of this land, and especially George, our president, and Richard, our vice president, with your life-giving spirit. Fill them with the love of truth and righteousness, that they may serve you and this nation ably and glad to do your will. Endow their hearts with your spirit of wisdom, that they may lead us in renewing the ties of mutual respect which form our civic life, so that peace may prevail with righteousness and justice with order. We pray that you will strengthen their resolve as they lead our nation seeking to serve you in this world, that this good and generous country may be a blessing to the nations of the world. And may they lead us to become, in the words of Martin Luther King, members of a beloved community, loving our neighbors as ourselves, so that all of us may more closely come to fulfill the promise of our founding fathers, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. All this we ask in your most holy name. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, the Honorable William H. Rehnquist.
The Chief did not come in with the rest of the Supreme Court. We wondered if that might be because they were hoping to spare him some chilly minutes out on the platform. But he is coming out now. Mr. Rehnquist has been ill for some time, has thyroid cancer, and is very frail, but he wanted very, very much to be here for this ceremony, and he has managed to be here. He's coming in his in the gold-trimmed robe that he initiated as the Chief Justice, something that Chief Justices have never worn before, but yes, it brings a little flair to the black robe, I suppose, and he's wearing a black beret as well. Walking a little unsteadily, but to his seat at the front of the
platform. And now, ladies and gentlemen, platform. It's my pleasure to introduce one of today's most popularly
the Chief Justice will later be, of course, presenting the oath of office to the President of the United States. And while there's some entertainment going on there at the event in front of the Capitol, we're here at the studios in Washington. This city, for those of us who live and work in this city, looks perhaps as the mall itself is perhaps never more crowded than it is on this day. The city itself is perhaps more deserted than it has ever been. A 100-block area of Washington, D.C. has been, cut off, surrounded by Jersey barriers. Those of us who were trying to maneuver around the city found it to be a puzzle palace of new passageways. This, of course, for the unprecedented security that surrounds this event. This inaugural, the first since the attacks on 9/11. Tom Ridge, the director, the Secretary of Homeland Security, says that there is no known threat to this event, despite the concentration of high government officials and dignitaries there at the Capitol, yet better to be safe than sorry. There are, of course, demonstrations underway today here in Washington, D.C. as well. Those opposed to President Bush's inauguration, various causes from making the streets open to bicyclists to those who say that the election was conducted unfairly in various places around the country. Those people will be having their voices heard from, of course, later today. But as Linda Wertheimer mentioned earlier today, this is quite a moment for Republicans around the country to celebrate a successful campaign, a campaign more successful than many of them had indeed even hoped, a campaign that not only saw the re-election of a Republican president, but expanded majorities in the House of Representatives and in the United States Senate. Republicans successful in many places. Republicans successful in many places in state legislatures as well. With me here in Studio 3A is national political correspondent Mara Liasson. And, of course, Mara, while we see former presidents Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton on that on the stage with President Bush as well. Both of them, his father is there, of course, as well. This is primarily a day for Republicans to celebrate.
There's no doubt about that. Republicans have consolidated power across the board in Washington and in the states in a manner that they really haven't done for probably 50 years. And it's a tremendous day of political triumph for the Republican Party. They put down very deep roots in this last election, way below the president and Senate and House level to state legislatures around the country. They're now just about at parity in terms of state legislatures around the country, and they control more state legislatures than the Democrats do. They control the majority of governorships and obviously the House and Senate and the White House, and that's a big, big gust of wind at the president's back as he tries to enact what is going to be a very, very ambitious and politically difficult agenda this year, this term.
We expect him to talk about some of those domestic items that you've been suggesting about in his inaugural address, plans to reform Social Security, plans to reform the United States tax code. These are issues of daunting. This is going to be extremely difficult to do. These are major issues. This is an ambitious presidential agenda. As you suggest, it's going to be difficult to do. But one thing about President Bush that we have learned over the years, it is generally a mistake to underestimate his ability to get his measures through.
Right. As he often says, people misunderestimated me. But I think the big difference between the first term domestic agenda and this term is the first term agenda was big, but it wasn't politically difficult. Tax cuts are almost, and big entitlement, new entitlements for Medicare, it's almost like giving people things. It's handing out candy. Now, with simplifying the tax code and revamping Social Security, you're asking for some sacrifice. He's never done that before.
Linda, we just heard Susan Graham, an opera singer raised in New Mexico and, of course, also raised in Texas, the president's home state.
A friend of the president's, I believe. Don Gagne is here with me on the platform, looking over the watching as the inauguration proceeds. We are very close to the inauguration, to the swearing in of Vice President Cheney. Don, this as we were just saying, as Mara and Neil were just talking about, we're looking at Republicans triumphant. This was an extraordinary campaign that the president conducted. It was close. Senator Kerry is sitting right down there, right in front of us. Very close, but very successful.
And again, as you look at essentially the entire government laid out before us here, just a few feet away, it is true that so many of the major players here are Republicans.
Here's the oath of office for the Vice President.
I, Richard Cheney, do solemnly swear
that I will defend and support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of my office.
And I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office.
On which I'm about to enter, so help me God.
On which I'm about to enter, so help me God.
Congratulations.
That's the Speaker in the House, Dennis Hastert, swearing in Vice President Cheney, who kisses his wife and his two daughters, who are standing on the platform with him. As you could hear, the oath the Vice President takes is identical to the oath that members of the House and Senate take as they are sworn in at the end after each election. The President's oath of office, as you are about to hear soon, is much, much shorter. This protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, as you heard, Mr. Hastert got backwards, and Mr. Cheney corrected him. We're moving on now another musical interlude, and then in just a few minutes, the Chief Justice will swear in the President. President Bush will be President of the United States for four more years. This is an extraordinary symbol, the inauguration of what a
different kind of country this is, the peaceful transfer of power, as the president's been talking about this week. But of course, as he corrected himself, I heard him the other day, this is not a transfer. He is reassuming the office, re-upping. This is Denise Graves, opera singer from Washington, D.C. Mezzo-soprano Denise Graves, brought up here in Washington. Her most famous role, I believe, is Carmen. Here is Senator Lott.
Beautiful, and sets the tone for what we're about to do. It gives me great pleasure to introduce the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, the Honorable William H. Rehnquist, who will administer the presidential oath of office. Justice Rehnquist.
Justice Rehnquist getting to his feet with the help of a cane and stepping up onto the platform. The president and his family are assembling.
Will you raise your right hand, Mr. President, and repeat after me? I, George Walker Bush.
I, George Walker Bush.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
There it is. President George W. Bush taking office for the second time. We hear the President's Own Marine Band playing Hail to the Chief. And the 21-gun salute, which is taking place in the park across from the Capitol grounds. Hear those big guns thumping. Most of the time we hear a 21-gun salute as a multiple of something. This time we hear all 21 guns. Returns to the podium, shaking hands with Senator Lott, and picks up a notebook which contains a copy of the speech and prepares to deliver his second and last inaugural address. Smiling and waving, looking around for old friends on the platform.
Vice President Cheney, Mr. Chief Justice, President Carter, President Bush, President Clinton, members of the United States Congress, Reverend clergy, distinguished guests, fellow citizens.